Okay, so Carmen, thank you very, very much. First of all, congratulations to finishing the project. I think you did a marvelous job, and you also, I'm very grateful because, in terms of content and in terms of perseverance, you were deeply, deeply inspiring and helpful in keeping it up. And why I needed to keep it up, I will go into in a minute. I'm a little bit sick, so I may be coughing in between, like now. So what I'm going to talk about is basically a research project that I conducted, an action-based research project that I conducted at the Rotterdam University. And you see here that I'm now a research professor for visual culture. I used to be the research professor for cultural diversity. I will go into that, but this change is also quite strategic, which you may understand later in the talk. Also, this is a little bit of an experiment for me because I'm going to talk freely for the first part, then go into a reading passage, and then I will come back into a more free floating conversation. Yeah? Also, before I'm going to talk, this may be a little bit of an Afro-pessimist conversation that I'm opening up, a very important conversation, and given that there is one more person of African descent, no, two more people of African descent in the room. It's quite interesting. Where is the space to talk about this? Yeah? So just to bring a little bit of awareness into that. And interestingly, there's a beautiful link to Ruben's talk because I have this quote at the beginning, "Minorities mark the beginning of their own enunciation by speaking from an anxious place of disavowal, from the hollows of denial, or the traces of repressed contradictions," by Humi Baba. And what do I mean by that, and how do I connect this to education? So for me, all these campaigns that I'm going to show you now are very much linked to the quintessential problem that I'm trying to address in my talk. So you had this hashtag campaign, I Too Am Harvard, which was bringing attention to the experience that students of color and students with like markers of difference have within educational institutions. And this went on into unlearn racism. This also traveled. I mean, the World Wide Web is connecting us. This is a student from Dresden who also contributed to the conversation. But more recently, I think very important, the notion of decolonization became very clear with the University of Cape Town that initiated Roads Must Fall, a decolonial approach that then traveled to Oxford with Roads Must Fall. So our colonial connections are becoming clearer and clearer in that. But for me, this is all also connected to a much deeper, deeper, deeper seated and rooted problem in our societies. And why am I bringing up Black Lives Matter will hopefully become more clear in a few minutes. However, for me, these moments, and I think that Ruben's argument fuels beautifully in that these cultural productions are, of course, they don't pass the educational system. So all of a sudden, you have the links. So why would it be like decolonizing this institution and Black Lives Matters? How does that come about? So actually, what we're facing is an epistemological problem, and this is what I want to predominantly talk about from a personal, but very much from an institutional perspective. However, so I am in Rotterdam, which is a con sorry, not a country. Holland is a country, small country, just like Switzerland. Also a Protestant country, very important, in which like a form of consent is extremely important. But Rotterdam is also the city in Holland which is by 2016 will be 55% of color and 45% white. So there is like the colonial heritage is very much present through people in the city, who reside in the city. However, the art school where I'm working is not reflecting these numbers whatsoever. And I will get into that. But the discourse that I'm talking about has arrived in the Netherlands. So there's now the University of Color, which came out of the, they call it the freeing of the main hall, not the occupation, the freeing. Student freed the main hall in the university and talked about their experiences of exclusion within the institution. So the question is, like, is Holland really changing? This year was the first time the Black Achievement Month, not Black History Month. There is no Black History Month in Switzerland, is there? No, okay. Maybe that's something to think about. So there were fest. It's always like cultural events, talks, etc. Very, very kind of spectacular, I would say. But this history, so this kind of up moving up from the students as well as from activists, puts institutions very much under pressure. So everyone is now talking in the institutions about decolonizing and bringing in more cultural diversity. For me, it is always important to talk about Europe as a post-colonial site, and I mean, Switzerland included, although Switzerland doesn't want to be part of the post-colonial project because it doesn't consider itself colonial. However, there's like a an antagonism here, obviously. And that's something that is not really understood in Holland. And I'm showing you here a poster that shows you a theater production from a small theater youth project in Rotterdam, and I looked at it. It's like a medley of Shakespeare, and when I looked at the group, they were all white, but this is the poster they chose, which is reminiscent of minstrel, which is also reminiscent of framing the Black female body as the vicious, bad angel that is seducing you with their glossy red lips. So there's obviously a problem going on, which is why I chose this Jinka Schönebauer piece that I love very much as an illustration. But for me, it's really the question how to close the knowledge gap. Yeah, how to talk exactly about the problem of what decolonization actually means. And I'm giving you another example, and I mean, this is quite famous, the Zwarte Piet conversation in the Netherlands happening very soon. That means that white people predominantly paint their faces like this, and they accompany Sinterklaas, who's coming by boat, and they are like Sinterklaas funny helpers, yeah? So their children love them. Zwarte Piet is rather stupid, etc. The UN has published a paper that clearly stated that this is derogative and racist, but the Dutch insist on reproducing this every year again. When the conversation started, though on the right side, there was a TV program that proposed on the left side, this is the classical Zwarte Piet. In the middle, this is a proposition that tries to not use any racial signifiers. And on the right side, you have the European Zwarte Piet. So they propose these different versions. And I just love this example because it shows you how helpless people are, right? Like, letting go of that tradition doesn't even come to mind. Why not? Why not changing? Why not innovating yourself? So for me, it's like there's an institutional gap. And this institutional gap is produced through what Michael Hanscher calls racial time. But this racial time is changed in the sense that during segregation, you used to have the distribution of books to from white schools to black schools with a temporal delay. That means you're creating a knowledge gap, right? So you are not bringing everyone onto the same level. So what I see now is that by keeping progressive and subversive theory outside of the institution, there's again racial time, but it means that the institution can remain the way how it is. And I will get into that further in the talk. So one of the problems that we are facing in Holland in particular is the problem of white privilege. And here's a beautiful quote also by a student, that white privilege is your history being part of the core curriculum and mine being taught in an elective. And in Holland just recently, and I can highly recommend it, Gloria Wecker, who is an emeritus professor of gender and critical race studies, who used to teach at the Utrecht University, has just published White Innocence, which is really, really amazing, and the first book that tries to tackle this. Gloria has death threats in Holland and is now leaving the country for half a year, and this is actually happening to anyone who is speaking up against the issue of white privilege in the Netherlands and also in other places. So for me, what is always important to talk about, or what I do in my classes, is to talk about the absent canon. And I'm going to show you a few people. We had Frantz Fanon, Edouard Glissant, Sylvia Winter, Stuart Hall, Maya Yim, Gayatri Spivak. Where is the next one? Bell Hooks. All my favorites in one slide. I love that. Edward Said. Where's the next one? Oh, here. Leopold Senghor, Hortense Billers, Paul Gilroy, my friend Corbina Mercer, Darby English. Now we're entering like art education, right? These are all art historians. So Darby English, Krista Thompson, Sylvester Ochibie, where else? Is there someone else? Oh, here, Suleiman Bashir Diané, Fred Moten, hero, and Sarah Ahmed. If you know about, like, let's say 90% of these people, you went to a different education than what is usually happening. So if you don't know these people, this is exactly what I'm talking about, yeah? Let me see where I am. Okay. So now I'm going into my written talk. Oh, I'm so good in time. Okay, I'm a little bit nervous because it's like with this microphone situation. Oh, thank you. It makes me also, it's like I'm talking in my own mind with this. Okay. So to decolonize the curriculum and pedagogical practices means to embrace the impossible. And the impossible for me here is not related to bringing non-Western epistemologies and content into established curricula and their related constructed canons. That would be an enterprise that could be established in a fairly short amount of time, I argue. But to convince university directors and teaching staff that these changes are quintessential to make a different future possible seems to be the impossible. The impossible is related to the internal intellectual and emotional transformation processes that are needed within art schools to make decolonization and change possible. By this I mean the intricate, self-motivated work that is necessary to understand one's historically produced position in the world, particularly as a person with white privilege. And this becomes even more complicated when that privilege is enhanced through being heterosexual, sexual, cisgender, and many other categories and identity positions that fuel into a suppressive normative order. Decolonizing work is uncomfortable work, and it is work that constantly challenges one's comfort zone and that can be at times so destabilizing that it increases neglect, rejection, and resistance. And this resistance can articulate itself in various forms, insufficient funding, rejection of research projects, social policing, or the refusal to hire staff that brings expertise in the field that are invested in social change, such as queer studies, post-colonial or decolonial theory, of which all of which lead into systematic exclusion. And I'm emphasizing systemic here because, as Art School Differences has repeatedly shown or concluded, the desire for diversity and change is present within art schools. But that desire seems to be fueled by the idea of not having to do the work. And by this, I don't mean programs and intercultural exchange that have the tendency to exotize the other and reproduce a status quo. The work means to start the reflection where it hurts the most, to look at our entangled histories without losing a track of the consistent intersectional power dynamics that reproduce themselves on a global scale. And the idea that everyone has to learn everything is, of course, a utopic and equally impossible wish, speaking against the hierarchies and often erasure of knowledges and practices that don't confine with the dominant narrative of modernity. A modernity that claims to be universal, but as Sarah Ahmed points out, the universal is a structure, not an event. It is how those who are assembled. It is how an assembly becomes a universe. The foundations of this modernity that we live in and that has from the beginning deprived Black and Brown people of our ontology created the legitimation for the unworthiness of our bodies, spirits, as well as labor. But this modernity is what we teach in various iterations, from kindergarten to university. And the philosopher Sylvia Winter, one of the most important post-colonial thinkers of our time, she's still alive, she's over 90 now, and author of an essay called No Humans Involved, to which I will come back later, has called us, and here I mean teachers and educators, out on reproducing the foundation of that modernity through an idea of human and humanity that places the category human outside of culture and subjectivity, but allowed to claim numbers and statistics as a classificatory and ordering belief system. This means by reproducing an idea of objective knowledge production, we reproduce the foundations of our disciplines and their hegemonic modes of economic rationality. Yes, there are now in Rotterdam additional courses that are called cultural diversity, electives which address postcolonial theory, or in other parts of the world there are entire departments dedicated to Black studies, postcolonial studies, or queer theory. But further, Winter shares that the exceptionalism with which any subject is treated that involves the other fuels into a whitewashing of our institutions and curricula. And that's something that she said in 1992. Approaches that don't confine with this modernity, which I argue have to be considered a practice rather than a static concept, so modernity has to be considered a practice rather than a concept. And these approaches are based on an understanding of learning as a holistic project, which is a threat to the establishment and questions our colleagues' mastery and knowledge base, as well as the institution's credibility, importance, and tradition. In my classes, I'm often confronted with the question, like, why haven't I heard this about Judith Butler's heterosexual matrix earlier? Why did I never read Frantz Fanon? How come I don't know about Sylvia Winter or Edouard Glissant? Well, my course is often an elective, of course. Well, I made this emphasis and now I lost my thread. Give me 1 second. Here we go. I have previously argued that critical educators have to deal with a different form of racial time, meaning that there is a chronopolitical dimension to our teaching. There's never enough time to catch up. in 1 week with theories and practices, which will neither the teacher nor the student allow to go beyond the content presented and further and deepen the subject. There's no thriving, only a scratching on the surface of possibilities. Since the content that I'm presenting to the students is based on foundational knowledge that has been produced by feminist, critical race, and queer and post-colonial thinkers and artists, which has a long-standing history, an erased history, also in this school, an erased history, it does not exist. Whereas if you look at the latest Beyoncé video, you will see that history. So contemporary education has therefore to be seen within the confines of what Alexander Wehaile calls the uneven global power structures defined by the intersections of neoliberal capitalism, racism, settler colonialism, immigration, and imperialism, which interact in the creation and maintenance of systems of domination and dispossession, criminalization, expropriation, exploitation, and violence that are predicated upon hierarchies of racialized, gendered, sexualized, economized, and nationalized social existence. So this is a lot, and this is heavy, and this is what we're dealing with here. So reading this quote by Alexander Wehaile that is so sharply points us readers to the heart of the contemporary dilemma clarifies that contemporary education has to tackle with all of the mentioned aspects at once, holistically, in order to create an understanding of our planetary system. Nevertheless, is the unthinkable often the desired outcome of critical educational approaches? But what does this mean as a practitioner and student? What kind of structures are necessary in order to be able to sufficiently teach everything? And what kind of work comprises a decolonial process? I want to move on to being a care worker. When I started my position at the Willem de Kooning Academy, I entered with high ambitions. I was promised free reign over the domain of cultural diversity. I was happy. I knew I was a token for the institution. Out of 57 lektoren, as we are called, research professors, there are 3 people of color, and I'm the only woman. And I mean, when you compare this number in the UK, you have 17 black women in higher education out of 19,000 professors. So I also knew that I was, as a black queer woman, not as threatening to the institution because I was not a black Dutch person. So my form of blackness is less threatening in that regard. I also knew that the work wouldn't be an easy one and that I would go through a lot of traumatizing experiences. So I know that in the decision-making of taking this job. Yeah, that's a very different way than I assume a white person that is going into a certain job. So that's clear from the very beginning. And I think that's something that shouldn't be underestimated and that has to be talked about. Otherwise, I don't know what we're talking about, really. But I told myself, hey, okay, my education was already quite a journey. So to survive the educational process was for me already like a point where I was like, now I can make a change. So I'm going to skip the part where I'm actually going to give you like about 20 anecdotes from my education. But being in the classroom and caring for my students consistently reminds me how much you have to give as a black person in a space that reproduces one's own trauma. Talking about whiteness with white people is not pleasant. It is not enriching me. It is not enlightening. And it is at times very, very draining, and you take it home with you. Yeah? It is a very self-destructive work if you don't manage to create an external support system through friends and family, how to deal with the harsh realities that you are confronted with. It is extremely skilled work, highly sensitive, and it demands expertise, which no diversity program can prepare you for, unfortunately. But that's an argument, maybe we can talk about that tomorrow. But that's really like that, I don't know how to learn this, I don't know how to teach that. It's really something that you have to go through, it seems. But this is the work and education, which is an emotional one, and this is an area which I see highly underestimated. Because if the social change we need, and you can contest me on that, involves emotional growth, and how can the epistemologies and methods that are constantly reproduced in our classrooms cater to the social change we are desiring? The system, how it functions right now, leaves basically the emotional waste work with those who are dedicated to do the work and deal with the thick layers of ignorance and privilege in and outside the classroom, in board meetings or in the private realm, which the white cultural hegemony has produced over centuries. So one of my conclusions here is that emotional labor is systematically underestimated and under-researched as well. And it repeats a violent cycle of resignation, frustration, and precarity. And I actually have here a quote that I'm not going to read to you, because but I'm happy to share it at another point. But there are two quotes that I actually wanted to share originally, to have a little bit more of a background in terms of many, many black women who start to write in blogs about their resignations at various institutions, various educational institutions, with exactly the same argument that it is not bearable work anymore. And one of them is an example, and you can look her up. Let me just see. Tamura Lomax. So when you conduct research on this, wait a minute, give me just a second. Here we go. When you so this is like, again, like making a reference to these plenty of personal accounts from the US and Europe that I have found. I have to emphasize that all of these accounts, including myself, are institutional, as Sarah Ahmeds also points out in her resignation statement from Goldsmiths College. So what I want to pose here today are two questions. And these are really questions. This is in the making. My work is underfunded in that regard. How do we measure success when the work is an emotional one? Work that tries to develop respect for themselves, for students themselves, and awareness in them. How do we shake off the trauma in the classroom and implement holistic approaches of self-care within the institutions instead of compartmentalizing it as a private matter, as if your depression is detached from the violence that you experience on a daily basis as a person of color? What I also did not take into consideration at the time when I took my position was the structural and systemic as well as emotional walls that I would encounter. Because social and systemic change won't happen via work on policies. You can change policies without changing anything. You can change policies in order not to change anything. It's another thing that Sarah Ahmed says, like a very wise woman, not part of our canon. And you can also not grant research funding and provide no structural support in order not to change anything. So the walls that I encounter are thick, and even more troubling, you encounter them on various different levels. Neoliberal universities have adjunct professors, lecturers on short-time contract, one-semester engagement in order to let these people who have been doing the work for centuries do the care work again, which allows them, the institutions, not to deal with their own business, with the unbearable, sheer, impossible task to deal with their white privilege. Yeah, this is like going back to the argument that you have like electives and you bring people with that expertise in, but making it like a substantial part of your institutional practice is not considered. It is actually too risky. And I want to bring in another set of questions by Sarah Ahmed, who actually basically asks, but what if we do this work and the walls stay up? What if we do this work and the same thing keeps coming up? What if our own work of exposing a problem is used as evidence there is no problem? Then you have to ask yourself, can I keep working here? What if staying employed by an institution means you have to agree to remain silent about what might damage its reputation? So this is something that I'm obviously not obeying to. I'm talking about this institution, and it actually has its repercussions. And one of these repercussions is partly produced through, this is a very recent publication by the head of the university where I'm working at, which is called Samenleving in the Moderne Samenleving. And you have one subparagraph here, a good example of diversity on the basis of norms. The Dutch context has this term called normen en waarde, which means norms and values. And these norms and values are very much this notion of commoning. Yeah, like create this common ground. We can all talk as long as you assimilate, and as long as you obey to our rules, it's okay. Yeah. Otherwise, if you speak out, you're called ideological or something like that. On a much more practical note, I also want to share with you my team. So this is my team, which is basically one person I'm working closely with and have stemmed a lot together with. But when you think about an entire art school, this is the structural non-support that I have been talking about. Yeah, and I'm using this because this is like a research and experience of 4 years, which is actually very rich in order to do it differently. Maybe. What we have done is we have preached to the choir. We did beautiful workshops with teachers who were willing and open to engage with notions of oppression. We used Augusto Boal's Theater of the Oppressed in order then to bring them together to have these theatrical workshops over 2 days. We do also brown bag lunch readings where we read literature on inclusion and exclusion or inclusive pedagogy once a month, which is now going to culminate in a beautiful publication. I'm very, very happy about that because without these people, without what I meant earlier, without the hard work, self-motivated work, you don't bring any change. And nevertheless, for me, it's always the problem that this, and this is why I'm talking so much about this experience and the emotional part, is that decolonizing does not mean Black and POC, people of colors, empowerment. Yeah, it's like that's what I mean with it is draining. It is not that I'm talking to the few Black students in the room about how to deal with these power structures. No, that's like seldomly happening. And I think that's also important. But what my students are predominantly confronted with, the Black students, is actually that you are, you know, this is like, again, I'm just bringing in another reference from the student's perspective. And I can tell you, after 4 years, I am so happy because they are mobilizing. They are the ones who are now coming up. We want this content and this knowledge much, much earlier. So which is why, if there are many students in the room, I can only motivate you to do the work. We also designed a new minor, so this is also an elective. However, the content that I was talking about is part of the curriculum, and interestingly pulls all of the Black POC and queer students in, because there's the content that you need in order to survive in that educational system. And they do beautiful projects. Here's one installation from our final exhibition by Zia Smets, who is a fine arts student. And they also, with them, it's so easy to talk about whiteness. So you have this example here of one group that basically created a video loop called White Noise that I cannot play for you because of time reasons right now. But they also embrace other subjects that I think are like to think about power relations and the dynamics of power and the police. This was this installation, for instance, which was detecting the police radio signals, and then was like, it's actually illegal, but bringing it into an art space, you can do it. So this is like the gap that they use, which I loved very much. I also connected the project to the city. So you see, with like two people, you can do actually a lot. Whilst I had a residency with the Witte de Witt Center for Contemporary Arts in Rotterdam, and we invited the collective, how do you say, Yaman African, who are a New York-based collective and whose work I have been writing about in my own PhD thesis on post-Black art. So also post-Black art is a theme that you can barely talk about, although it is state of the art, it's actually post-post-Black. But if you haven't heard of post-Black yet, again, the symptom of the same problem. Post-Black was a theme that was introduced by, or framing of Black artists by Thelma Golden and the director of the Studio Museum in Harlem, New York, and the painter Glenn Ligon, who detected that there was something different about this post-civil rights movement generation. So they coined this term. So these artists did not want to be called Black artists anymore. However, their work was really deeply invested in Black culture and in the history of the Black arts movement, etc. And if you look at contemporary artistic developments in the Black diaspora, and if you're interested in that, which is not an isolated enclave in the world, then you see the different influences. But if you are teaching at an art school, and if you're a student at an art school and you don't know about this, how are you supposed to be, you know, like, how do you want to be a cultural producer? I mean, it's missing, and you're missing out. So what we did was no humans involved, and here you see also, because I was reading to you from the piece No Humans Involved, NHI, by Sylvia Winter, that at the end, what we're doing in the art school by reproducing the sort of classificatory system and normative orders, we are reproducing the same power structures that actually led to this acronym NHI to come into being. And NHI, No Humans Involved, was used by the LAPD in 1992. It leaked when Rodney King, who passed, the late Rodney King, when Rodney King was beaten down by five police officers. What they said was No Humans Involved. And every crime that involved a rape crime, queer people, as well as Black youth, was called NHI. So the dehumanization. This is exactly where I'm coming in with the epistemology, with ontology, the non-existence. And these were themes that these artists were exploring in their work. They were exploring it through really thinking through what are alternative epistemologies, where does materiality come in. And I just want to share with you one beautiful image of the immortal uterus, which was a structure made out of VHS tape, beautiful reference to representation, of course, of Black bodies. But it was the immortal uterus. It was round and a huge sculpture where you could walk in. The light was blue, and in this uterus was standing for Henrietta Lacks's stem cells, cancer stem cells. So Henrietta Lacks was a Black woman whose cells were the first cells that reproduced themselves, cancer cells, which is still patented, is still the same stem cells are used in cancer research till the contemporary. Yeah, so this was in the 1950s, I think, in a major, major breakthrough. So how actually the Black bodies are still the healer, as well as the system is trying to basically erase us. And of course, I involved students in that. Here's the weaving of that sculpture. So in order to have that dialogue and to sensitize really what a different epistemology could mean. And this weaving, I must admit, was one of the most relaxing and nicest teaching sessions I think I've ever had. And, you know, like just to think through things like that. I'm coming to an end now. I'm just in time. I won't share many more images with you. Just that through the help of the Vitta Divitt, there was a possibility to create a link between the discourses that I was interested in, that I was trying to bring into the school, and bring them back into the city, and involve communities who are usually not part of the white cube. And in that regard, I think it's interesting that I needed to go outside of the school, yeah, which is also something that Fred Moten right now is talking about in terms of the undercommons, etc. So this is a little bit of an insight. I'm very happy to answer questions if we still have time, and say again, thank you.